Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Oh, wow.
Now, what you just said just before that, I just clicked.
It's 2020?
Yeah. So
it's
the international year of?
Of?
The rat?
No. Of, and I saw this the other day and I couldn't figure it out. It's the international year of good eyesight.
Good eyesight.
2020.
Oh.
Click. I just got it. I just got it right then.
I didn't know that international year of
that. Neither did I, but now it all makes sense. There we go. I'm a 2020 guy, by the way.
Oh, just, you say 2020?
Yeah, I do.
Why?
I do, because it's the way that you should say it.
Really? I got
because the number's not 2020,
but
is it?
But the news rule, how do you say 2019? Do you say 2019?
Yeah,
yeah. Oh, yeah, no, see, we got taught 2008, for example.
Yeah.
But 2018, for example.
But where's why? Why not 2008 versus 2018?
2008.
Do you say
I
like 1,920?
I knew you were going to say it, but 1900 is acceptable.
1900
and 20. Is acceptable, but 2000 is certainly not acceptable.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that we've sorted that out. I was definitely wondering. But our first, we're going to go through some anniversaries
that
will be celebrated throughout this year, I presume.
Yep,
they're not all today.
No, they're not all today, but they're certainly all this year. And I guess, as you know, humanity has some sort of predilection with sort of anniversaries and, you know, hundreds and 50s and 25s and those, you know, sort of magic numbers. And so I thought it was an appropriate thing to kick off this year with some of these anniversaries that are going to be happening in the year 2020 or the year 2020, depending on how you want to do it. And the first big one is it's 200 years this year since the discovery of a thing called electromagnetism.
Ooh.
Which is kind of important. And in fact, it was really only sort of 20 years before that let's say electricity was discovered, and I'm doing the air quotes here, when a guy named Volta basically invented the thing called the battery, which we all know of. And so the battery allowed us to utilize electricity essentially for the first time in a controlled fashion and not have to rely on lightning strikes and stuff like that.
Cool.
And so 20 years after Volta came along with his battery, there was a Danish guy by the name of Hans Christian Ørsted, and he was giving a lecture. And he just happened to have a battery on hand in this lecture, and he also happened to have a compass. And while giving this lecture, he found that when he passed an electric current through a wire that was close to the compass, it deflected the compass. It made the compass move.
Oh, right.
Ah,
okay.
See okay. So we have electricity. Okay. So we've got electricity running through the wire, or an electric current running through the wire as a result of the battery.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got the compass operating on magnetic principles, because as we know, the compass points towards magnetic north, and it's influenced by a magnetic field. And so therefore, Ørsted was the first to show that an electric current had an associated magnetic field with it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that's why the compass deflected. And that was a big, enormous bloody discovery.
Revelation.
Although it really probably wasn't, you know, realized as such at the time. So that's what electromagnetism is. It's basically this whole thing that electricity and magnetism are intimately mixed.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So they're essentially kind of one and the same thing, sort of.
And is this related to sort of electromagnetic radiation?
Absolutely, it's related to electromagnetic radiation, which we're going to get on and talk about in the next.
Ooh.
Oh, very, very nice, nice segue.
I actually hadn't planned that, just so everybody knows.
But the whole thing about this is that a few years later, a guy by the name of Michael Faraday, a very, very famous scientist, showed kind of the opposite, that if you moved a magnet, it would generate or induce an electric current. Okay, so one and the same thing. And that's the way that we generate our electric current now. That's the way we generate power, is essentially through moving magnets and turbines, blah, 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 and your hydroelectric station. So, you know, that's a big thing. 200 years
massive.
Since that.
Massive. Very massive thing. Okay. Well, thank you.
And then, as you said, electromagnetic.
Yes.
Yes. So it's 125 years this year. So it was 1895 that X-rays were discovered.
Oh, wow.
By the guy by the name of Wilhelm Röntgen.
And also very useful.
As a result of that, he ended up being immortalized on the periodic table. He gets element 111 named after him, Röntgenium.
Oh,
Yeah, so
can't
that's,
say I know the elements. Sorry.
Not many people do, but so he discovered X-rays. Now, X-rays obviously extraordinarily useful because
absolutely.
They can pass through soft tissue, but not through bones, and so therefore the essentially the first X-ray image was of Roentgen's wife's hand. And if you look anywhere on the internet, you'll find this particular image. And it's kind of cool because you just see the bones in her hand and then you see a big ring around her finger.
Ah.
Very, very cool. So I urge you to check that out. Now, what's that got to do with electromagnetism or electromagnetic radiation? X-rays are electromagnetic radiation. And light is also electromagnetic radiation. So X-rays are just a form of light, essentially. It's a very, they're very, very, very energetic, very intense form of light. And that's, you know, why you can pass them through soft tissue but not through bones.
That's amazing.
Okay, so that is an enormous discovery. Obviously, that revolutionized medical diagnoses way back in the sort of the early 20th century, et cetera, et cetera. Sadly, people didn't realize that sort of X-rays were kind of not the best for you.
Ah, so they, well, even the fact, because I was, you were told to take off jewelry,
yeah,
or,
yeah,
you know,
yep,
when you go for an X-ray,
yep,
so they
like
wouldn't
that.
Have known that on that first.
No, they wouldn't. And I remember sort of stories of, I think sort of maybe the 1920s or 30s or something like that, that they used to, in shoe stores, they used to have this thing, I think they called it a fluoroscope or something, where you could actually see the bones in your feet sort of moving,
oh,
and they would
wow.
supposedly fit your shoes, you know,
according
correctly.
To, that's amazing, though.
Yeah, yeah, but it's not the best for,
no.
you know.
How long did it take for them to realize that you shouldn't be pregnant also? Because that's like a red line, right?
Yeah, that's a really good question, which I do not know the answer to, which I probably should. But I think, you know, as was the case also with radioactivity, which was discovered the year after, they didn't realize the dangers, I guess, of these things until a few years sort of down the track. So, you know,
they would have had to have used it.
Yes, yeah, and then
lot,
found that.
Because it was very exciting.
Yeah,
and then,
yeah. So X-rays, big discovery. So
wow,
that's 125 years this year.
Okay.
And X-rays, again, segue perfectly into the next one because 2020... is the 100th anniversary or the centenary of the birth of one Dr. Rosalind Franklin.
Yes, okay.
And she...
is a chemist, I noticed.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure whether she would have referred to herself as being a chemist or not. I really don't know. Possibly more of a physicist.
Okay.
But absolutely instrumental in the discovery of the structure of DNA. And again, I think her contribution to this, or the knowledge of her contribution to this, has just increased and increased over the past sort of 20, 30, 40 years, I would say. So for those of you who don't know, so this was 1953, and Watson and Crick were busy doing work on the structure of DNA, as was Rosalind Franklin, and as was our own Morris Wilkins, Kiwi-born. And so of these people, Rosalind Franklin was a what we would call an X-ray crystallographer these days. And what happens?
Crystallographer.
Crystallographer,
wow.
Okay. So I've already said that you can shoot X-rays through soft tissue, but not through bone, things like that. If you take a chemical compound and you make crystals of it, you get nice crystalline material, things like copper sulfate and stuff like that, all those beautiful blue crystals that you might have seen when you were a kid at high school and everything. You shoot X-rays at those crystals, then what happens is the X-rays get deflected. And the way in which they get deflected, if you analyze the pattern that they make when they get deflected, so they get deflected in all sorts of directions. If you can analyze that pattern, which you can, then you can figure out what the actual positioning of the atoms in that crystal are.
Wow.
Okay? And that's pretty amazing stuff. And that's been known for, oh gosh, over a century or so now, but incredibly useful. And Franklin, Rosalind Franklin, was the first person to actually get some decent X-ray photographs, if we'll call them that, of DNA.
Amazing.
And just doing that was an achievement in itself. An amazing achievement in itself. Now, the sad thing is that she didn't, and I hope I'm not going to get in trouble for saying this, she wasn't able to analyze the photographs that she got in terms of working backwards and finding out what the positioning of the atoms and DNA were.
Okay.
Whereas Watson and Crick, that was their sort of expertise. They knew what sort of photographs a particular orientation of DNA would give.
Right.
And so depending on which story you read or believe or whatever, Wilkins, who was apparently working with Franklin, showed Watson and Crick her photographs, and they immediately recognized what the pattern meant, and they then recognized that, okay, DNA had to be a double helix. And so they, along with Wilkins, ended up getting the Nobel Prize for not chemistry, for medicine and physiology in 1962, okay? And then you ask, why didn't Franklin get it? Franklin didn't get it because, unfortunately, she died in 1958. So the story goes again, and you can't give posthumous Nobel Prizes. So as the story goes, had she been alive at that stage, then she would certainly have shared at least...
Been included in that, in the
Nobel Prize.
Oh, okay.
So it's a really interesting story.
Yes.
And, you know, that's the way that science works. Science... science isn't the work of one person.
No, not at
and
all.
It requires input from, you know, a whole lot of people.
Yeah.
And a whole process.
All right.
So that's the 100th birthday of Rosalind Franklin.
Okay, happy birthday.
And 2020 is also 100 years since the prediction of a thing called a neutron.
Okay,
and that
yes.
was by our good old Ernest Rutherford, who utter giant in science. And so Rutherford, excuse me, as you should know, hopefully, or you should have been taught in school, he figured out what the structure of the atom was. He said that the atom was mostly empty space.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of the atom, you had this big, massive... Not big sizably, but massive, positively charged thing.
Yeah.
And then the electrons are sort of floating around that sort of elsewhere.
Yeah.
And he sort of said, right, this positive charge on the nucleus of the atom comes from a thing called a proton, a particle called a proton. And he was the first person to basically figure out that that's the way it should be. However, he realized that there was something wrong with his model because there was mass that he couldn't account for in the nucleus.
Yes.
And so in 1920, he came up with a postulate and said, right, my model is not totally correct. I know that there has to be another particle in the nucleus, and it has to be neutral charge.
Yeah.
Okay. And if it's neutral charge, then that means it should be able to travel through matter quite easily.
I remember this.
And so he predicted that. And then in 1932, his student, James Chadwick, discover the neutron. So again, this is science in action.
I did get taught this.
Good.
Shout out to my fifth form chemistry teacher.
Oh, amen. Very good. So it's 100 years since he came up with the prediction of the neutron.
Neutron. Okay. Awesome. Okay, now final one.
And the final one, 2020, is 75 years since 1945, and in 1945, first atomic bomb.
Ah, yes.
Okay, and so this was in New Mexico in July. 1945, not obviously the more famous or infamous ones on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Mm-hmm.
This was basically the first test that showed that the bomb actually worked. And so less than a month later, it was then used, sadly, in anger for the first and hopefully the last time.
Mm-hmm.
An enormous scientific advance. The ethics of the whole thing can be debated ad infinitum.
Yeah.
But the actual science of this was astonishing, and what they did in such a short period of time to unleash the power of the chemical nucleus or the atomic nucleus was quite extraordinary, quite amazing, because, you know, what they did, the war basically forced them to get the finest minds from pretty much around the world, I guess, or the Allied side, and put them all together and basically tell them, right, you know, let's make this work.
Yeah.
And they did. And so that's a remarkable achievement as well. So there's a whole host of very, very important anniversaries, I think, coming up this
big year.
Big year. Yes, absolutely.
So
yes.
Very good to look ahead to this. Do you want to just quickly run through your last story?
We can go very quickly through
yes.
that. I can see you're hurrying me up.
Okay. No, I'm looking forward to hearing. I mean, I'm sure we will probably touch back on those anniversaries throughout the year, but
we will. So on January the 3rd this year, a lady by the name of Dr. Frances Arnold, who just happens to be the fifth female Nobel laureate in chemistry, and she won the Nobel Prize in 2018. And she said on Twitter, and I quote, "For my first work-related tweet of 2020, I am totally bummed to announce that we have retracted last year's paper on enzymatic synthesis of beta-lactams. The work has not been reproducible." And she then went on to say, "It is painful to admit, but important to do so. I apologise to all. I was a bit busy when this was submitted and did not do my job well." Wow.
A very honest apology.
Oh, hell yes. That takes guts to do that, okay? So again, this is the way that science works. Sometimes you're wrong, you know? And in the rush to publish, the enormous pressure to be first for any, you know, big new discovery or whatever, people make mistakes sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think it's amazing that, A, she put out such a candid
message.
Tweet, I guess,
yeah.
message.
Yeah.
And B, she's kind of taking the rap herself,
yeah.
okay? She wouldn't have done the work. No way. The work would have been done by students in her lab.
Right.
Okay? And so it is the responsibility of the what we call the principal investigator, mm-hmm. the PI,
yep.
In any scientific endeavor, to check and just make sure that everything is, you know, fair and above board and everything like that, and that things work and that things are reproducible. And, mm-hmm. you know, she obviously, as she says, she was a bit busy, and, you know, she'll in between giving countless lectures because
yeah,
she's a Nobel laureate, running around the world, keeping track of all of her students, of which she'll
yeah.
have, you know, tens, twenties in the lab. It's a tough
job.
How
many papers would a person like that, you know, release or publish every year?
Oh, that's a really good question. Maybe between, at a guess, I would say between, say, 20 and 50, something like
right.
that.
So is it kind of a big deal that this one paper didn't go through, or?
Yeah, it is. It's a big deal because it was obviously a good paper because it got published in a very, very good
right,
journal.
Right.
Okay. What you often find, a retraction per se is sadly not as rare as we'd like it to be. There are quite a few retractions, and often the reason that things are retracted is because of scientific misconduct.
Yeah,
which
rather
we can
than
go
actual.
Into in another day.
Yeah.
rather than just an honest mistake, which
yeah.
this appears to be. Okay.
Do you think that? I mean, there's heaps of science, right, happening. I'm saying
oh, yeah.
that really generally,
no,
and
you're
there
right.
always has been heaps of science, and there's always experience, and there's always research and publishing, and da 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 da.
Yep.
I think that that's just going to increase, right?
Oh, it is.
And
yes,
so there
absolutely.
Will be more retractions, hopefully,
the
in the sense that people were honest enough to do that.
Yes. Well, again, as I say, it's going to be one of two reasons. It's either honesty or it's dishonesty.
Yeah, right.
Basically.
Right. If it gets, yeah. Okay.
But for somebody who is so high profile, this is almost, I sort of can't remember anything like this from certainly a Nobel laureate. I can't remember a Nobel laureate having to retract an article because of a mistake. There's sort of a couple of famous examples of a little bit of dishonesty, possibly, but you know, this is unprecedented. So kudos to her.
What was her name?
Frances Arnold.
Frances Arnold. I'm going to remember
Caltech.
That name.
So, you know,
go
Frances. I think it's fantastic, and she's getting all sorts of thumbs up and everything
yeah.
on the Twitter sphere, and all around the scientific world for actually, you know,
professionalism,
being gutsy enough
really.
To do this, because she could have just left it. And probably it wouldn't have been found, probably, you know, but, you know, she had the guts to say, hey, sorry, you know, we got it wrong. And so,
brilliant.
You know, good on her.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to the year.
Aren't
2020, 2020, however you want to say it. We've got lots to talk about, I bet.
Indeed.
Thank you for making your way through the maze of construction. Alan, and apologies, listeners, for the drilling going on in the background. We'll be back after this.
Mind blown. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.